The theme for the afternoon talk is getting behind the thought. Earlier this month, I was at a meeting in what's called one of the committee rooms of the Houses of Parliament in London. And the purpose and the intention behind that meeting was to see and explore the possibility of whether there may be a ministry for peace, or a ministry for peace and reconciliation, which would be a ministerial position or post within the government of the United Kingdom. And at that meeting, with about 20 of us, including a number of members of parliament, number of people who have concerns and some experience in these matters. And part of the intention and purpose behind this meeting was that with so much violence in this world, starting of course from the home and domestic violence to street violence, social violence, violence in sports, violence in forms of the entertainment industry, and of course national and international violence. Needs to be ways to really address this very serious problem and all the terrible consequences of suffering, imprisonment, death, executions that take place in this violence. And a similar parallel project is taking place to establish there a department, as it would be called in the United States, of peace. And we sometimes forget that our political leaders are very, very much influenced by what the corporate world tells them, and especially what by the military world. And so part of the purpose of getting this exploration underway is to see whether it's possible to establish a different kind of voice, in the corridors of power, in government. And this is why we're calling it the Ministry for Peace, the Ministry for Peace and Reconciliation, which would look at the problem of violence right from the home and children and very young ones, and all the way through every spectrum of society and every aspect of foreign policy, to see whether there are other ways to resolve this nightmare situation, which goes on and on in the world and never gets the real attention that it deserves. And one of the things I noticed in this particular meeting, I and others had a chance to raise our voice, were two things. One was that whenever anything new is brought in, any kind of fresh idea or real concern, how quickly the doubters, those with doubt, immediately come in. "Oh, we can't do that," said one government minister. "Oh, these are nice ideas," which he hadn't even heard what they were. "But perhaps we could incorporate some of these ideas into some of our other departments," which of course is an immediate watering down that it would be forgotten. Another said, "Well, I don't think we're ready for this." Another said, "Well, it sounds a bit new agey to me," etc. And so sometimes there comes an idea, something worthwhile exploring, and immediately, as many of us notice, there's immediate walls of resistance. There's immediately some cynicism, some, "Oh no, this can't be done, this isn't possible." And in this particular meeting, and I think I commented, if I may say, fairly directly to one of the MPs, those of you who have a connection with politicians at times, it's not the easiest species to deal with. And sometimes, in this particular one, in speaking there, I asked the members of parliament who were there, just a small group from different the government, and the Labour Party, and the Conservatives, Lib Dems. I said, which of you of the MPs would be actually willing to actually explore this, would actually be willing to discuss this, to bring it to the attention of other members of parliament, which you would start something going within the within parliament itself, because that's what you're here for, for the will of the people. And I said, because if you do, then you'll be treated lightly, you'll be considered that this is a naive and foolish idea, that it won't work, that it's not possible, that one's out of touch with reality, etc., etc. So which one of you has the courage to actually take a step forward and be the subject of gossip and dismissal behind your back in Parliament? And I looked around at them, and not one of them said a word. They all looked down the floor, they looked around, anything but looking Christopher's eyes. And therefore, so I said, well, it's as always, Parliament is the last to hear about anything which is important. And that means then it has to come from people working, campaigning, and having another meeting in Parliament next month. And I just use this as an example. And I'm sure, no doubt, our friends in Washington DC are experiencing exactly the same problems with the Senate or the congressman. And sometimes, you see, something comes to us. It might come to us on a retreat. Somebody said to me the other day with Gurdjieff, the intuitive idea, the intuitive moment of something valuable, something important, and how this needs to be actualized, it needs to be brought into the world. Even if it doesn't work, even if nothing seems to come of it, but one takes the germ, one takes the seed of the idea, and then from that seed of the idea sees what is possible, what actually can be actualized there. And the difficulty with our thoughts and the sheer numbers of thoughts that are often, as we say in English, it often hides the wood for the trees, or is it the trees for the wood, I can remember. And meaning that when there is so much thinking going on in our mind, so many ideas, so many views, so many opinions, then it's very difficult in that accumulation and gathering and momentum of so much thinking to actually see what's valid, what's creative, what can be actualized, what can be expressed, because our mind is overburdened with so much ideas, overburdened with so many things I could do, or I could start, or I could initiate, or I could work with, or whatever. And as we see with the days of our retreat, part of the purpose and the function of this retreat, I say part, not a major part, but a part, is to find ways and means to reduce, to cut down, to starve the mind of this excess of thinking. And in that we've been using the various resources of mindfulness and awareness and witnessing and watching and paying attention to breathing and the sounds of the day and the nature and walking, etc. And all of that is rather helpful and hopefully and useful vehicles in life. Just want to create a little bit more inner space, a little bit more receptivity to see what deep and profound can emerge out of us. And often, as I say, we are overburdened with knowledge. We are overburdened with information. And I remember in the monastery, We didn't have newspapers there. We were liberated from Time magazine, and there is a kind of delusion that we have that we need to know. And in fact, the more we know, the less we know. The more we know, the less we realize. We've actually overburdened our poor old minds so that the inner life really doesn't really have the opportunity to breathe. It doesn't have the opportunity to open up and expand because we're constantly bringing in more and more information. And the outcome of all the information and all that excess of thought that goes with it, that it brings in the inner life and in the emotional life a kind of paralysis. It brings about a paralysis, an inability to respond. And the most frequent mantra in situations is, oh, what can you do? And that's a tragedy. It's a tragedy for a human being to give up on life, to give up on transformation, either inwardly or outwardly, because the mind feels weighed down with the information, weighed down with the knowledge, and that's not giving the depth, the intuitive depth of the inner life, a chance to breathe, a chance to find some space so that something might come through that expresses something beautiful for life. And I do feel in the old tradition of renunciation that amongst the many renunciations, we often think of material renunciations, which are important, but I do think a major one for our culture and our time is just finding a right relationship with knowledge, finding a right relationship with information there, because it comes through our television, it comes through our newspapers, it comes through the magazines, it comes through all the stories, it comes through all the different vehicles our eyes and ears have every day. And we need space for something deep and intuitive to be able to flow through us. Otherwise we all end up feeling helpless, feeling hopeless, feeling there's nothing that we can do. And when there is nothing that we can do, we leave it to people who are on another trip altogether with life. And we all know what kind of people we're talking about. With the world of thought itself, which has, as I say, a kind of exaggerated place in the field of things, that in one of the suttas of the Buddha, he speaks about working with, well, speaks many places, but it's particularly about working with thought. And that means the whole world of ideas, views, opinions, conceptions, mental constructions, ideation, beliefs, opinions, all that can go on and on inside of us. And there are about five different suggestions to help find a little bit of space, and I even wrote them down on a piece of paper just in case I forget them, which is a fair chance. One of them, which is what we've been doing here, is really just to observe them, nothing else. And the observation of thought is the seeing of a thought as a thought. To observe thoughts is the seeing of these thoughts, the witnessing of these thoughts as thoughts. Not to invest, not to infect, not to exaggerate their authority. And that begins to take out some of the power out of the excesses of thinking, and that brings about a receptivity so that thought which is valuable, thought which is insightful, thought which has some healthy power to it, can be much more accessible, simply because we're learning to see thought as thought. And the probability is 99.999 99.999% is hopeless, useless thought. How many thoughts have we had in a week here? I read in saw one of those wretched television advertisements that the average person, whoever Mr. and Mrs. Average are, has 13,164 thoughts a day. I don't know who's been doing the counting, but and some will be sitting here and think, God, I wish I only had 13,164 thoughts. God, lucky Mr. and Mrs. Average, etc. So one is the giving the attention to thoughts and seeing thoughts as thoughts. The second is not easy. None of these things are ever easy. The Buddha says, intentionally think about something else. Why not? One is obsessing thinking about something or someone. Most obsessive thinking has in it the self. Most obsessive thinking. I, etc. Mostly the self is in most obsessive thinking. Sometimes it's not. It might be some philosophical issue or theological issue or sociological issue, etc., etc. But a lot of it has got the self slap in the center of it. There. So sometimes one says, okay, the observing isn't working. I just keen to jump into the swamp of the thinking. Therefore, one intentionally and deliberately thinks about something else. Second. A third is to give some thought to the result of all this thinking about. What's going to be the outcome of me just thinking about this? And sometimes we look at what the result will be, and one asks oneself, what's going to go if I go on thinking like this all the time, today, all tonight, and all tomorrow, how am I going to feel at the end of it? That should encourage anybody to cut the thinking quickly. So some reflection on the result of the thinking. What's going to be the outcome if I go on thinking like this? Fourth is, what do I need to be clear about? Sometimes all the thinking about, whatever it might be, is in the disguise of, if I keep thinking about it, I'll get clearer about it. This is one of the great deceits of the human species. I keep thinking about it, and I'm telling myself, I get thinking about it, and I get clearer about it. And sometimes, miraculously, it happens. And believe me, it's a far greater miracle than that rabbi walking on water a couple of thousand years ago. One says, oh, I thought about it, and then, after two or three years, I got quite clear about it. Meanwhile, one has completely missed the rest of existence. So because sometimes it happens, then easily the thought comes, thinking is to get clear. Sometimes thinking is to get more and more unclear. Sometimes thinking is to get more and more confused, more and more judgmental, more and more reactive. And with all of that, what goes along with it is the justification for it. So one keeps justifying the thinking, keeps justifying the attitude, keeps justifying the reactivity, keeps justifying the judgmental mind, and one again gets caught along with it, with the fragmentation that goes with our life between oneself and others. And sometimes, the fifth, is with resolution. We can tell ourselves in the middle of a lot of thinking, oh, I don't need to keep thinking about this. This is another thought. It goes with the package. So there's a lot of thinking going along, and then in the thinking come some thoughts, I shouldn't be thinking all this about this. And then one goes back to the thought, and someone carries on the thinking. Because the thought is of I shouldn't be thinking is only the dualism, to use the technical language, in the thinking. I'm thinking, I shouldn't be thinking. And then I go back to thinking, and then I shouldn't be thinking. And so one is moving in these ways of thinking, thinking, thinking. So this requires some resolution. It requires some resolve. And sometimes we have to ask ourselves, not mentally, but deep, deep down, am I genuinely interested in cutting this thinking? Is the resolve there to stop the thinking? Would I be willing, as the Buddha asked, would I be willing, where there's a lot of this unnecessary, futile thinking, would I be willing to suppress the thought? So that one has a determination through observation, through changing the thinking, through some reflection on the result, through some interest in what the thinking is all about, and is there another way to look at this situation, through the resolution. If we really start applying different ways to work with unhealthy, unwholesome, unskillful and utterly useless thinking, if we really start exploring the different ways, then there is the potential for us to really start transforming all this indulgence in the thinking. That then may allow us, may give us this little opportunity not to be so much in our thought, not so much in our head. And then the thinking, which is a wonderful resource, can work beautifully in harmony with perception, in harmony with clarity, in harmony with love, with vision, and it fits into something, and one doesn't feel oppressed by it. One doesn't feel that the thoughts are oppressing oneself. But I commented, those with great wisdom, though extraordinary thing to say, what those with great wisdom can think what they wish to think and do not think what they do not wish to think. Now that's something, isn't it? Eh? One thinks what one wants to think and one does not think what one does not want to think. Going to a good definition of enlightenment, you've just got it. And there is the capacity to, through awareness and observation and samadhi and understanding, really to, as one of the people here was telling me, that sometimes he just recognizes what his practice is the noticing the stream of thought and then just coming back to the moment when the thought started. What triggered it? What was the moment that it started? Was it something one saw or heard? Or was it an old memory or something? Was it a sensation in the body that started it? What was it that started it? And is it running along? And can one turn one's eye of wisdom, as it were, back to see what started it? What was the spark? What was the trigger? Then we get more back to a bare actuality. And in that bare actuality is the real opportunity for much more clarity, much more focus. And sometimes we do need to give care and attention, obviously, to what is worth thinking about. What's worth really reflecting on? Are we generating some time and opportunity in the life? And then to ask, what's the benefit of the result? if one really gives some time for some reflection or some wise thought about something, what's the benefit for oneself? What's the benefit for others? What's the benefit for life or for the environment or whatever? And so the intention comes, wise thought, connection with result. Intention, wise thought, which we call reflection, and cultivation of the result. All of that is part of our inner work and inner process. Sometimes, we touched upon this in one or two of the inquiries, and that is our, and in one of the talks as well, this area of attachment and holding on to. And what I've got in mind here is that sometimes in this relationship to the world, we say, this is good. And one of the great dangers for human beings, and a major one, is the attachment and the holding and the belief and the clinging to the idea of what is good. All this evil in the world, to use such a word, all that's not good in the world doesn't come from itself. Not possible. It can't. Wickedness, evil, that means the intention, infliction on of suffering on oneself or others or whatever, can't come from itself. It comes out of this relationship that human beings have with the idea and the belief and the grasping and the clinging onto the idea of what is good. And sometimes, in small things in life or in larger things of life, we look at our relationship to life and we take up the idea of what is good. And then we begin to think about it. We begin to invest in it. We begin to identify with it. We begin to believe in it more strongly. And the more that we actually do that kind of holding, then the more the mind has to swing to the idea of what is bad, or what is not good, or what is evil, etc. Forgetting that others are doing exactly the same, because the mind only knows how to work in that way. So others grasp onto their idea of what is good, or what is right, believe in that, hold to that, cling to that, and when two individuals in an argument, two groups of people, or two nations, or whatever it might be, holding and clinging to the belief in good, all hell will break loose. Because both are so attached to the idea of being in the right. Outwardly, it seems like big differences of view. Deep down, both are in the same misery, are in the same nightmare, of believing that they're on the side of the right, that they're on the side of the good. And this infects human life, infects it. And it's an extraordinary thing for a human being to stand back from oneself. Oneself means one's beliefs, one's views. It's an extraordinary thing for us to be able to stand back and to look at not only the idea of good and not good, but very importantly to look at the beliefs and the clinging around it. And every time you and I are in an argument with any other individual and are in dispute and we're in conflict, one is clinging to the idea of what is right, clinging to the idea of what is good. And then the feeling can arise, well, if I don't argue my corner, if I don't fight, if I don't say anything, then the other person will get his way, or she will get her way, or they will get their way, or we have to bring in the lawyers or whatever to sort it all out, or the counsellors or whatever, when there is the clinging. But the clinging is to break out of the fixation, to break out of the holding, so that perhaps we can see other ways of looking at it, because we are so stuck in the view, we're stuck in the belief we are right, and we can't see other avenues to look and explore, to change and transform. And that's an extraordinary thing to look at. And sometimes we are so afraid, we are afraid to speak up, we are afraid to say anything, even when it's happening all around us. To give you a small example of what I mean, my daughter, Nashona, she's 22 years old, she was earlier this month, and we have in Britain these small, and thank goodness, small political parties. One is called the BNP, the British National Party. Basically, it's right wing, extreme right wing. It's, you know, strong fascist kind of leanings. And we had the local election campaigns taking place in our county. And they were putting out in their leaflets, they were campaigning for it, but I found it sick and obscene, I'm sure you do as well, for South Devon, which is where I live in the West Country of England, to be a multicultural free zone. Understand? Multicultural free zone. In other words, whites only. They were campaigning for it because there are many people seeking asylum in Britain, and if I had my way, I'd say they're all welcome. Government has a different view. So they were campaigning for our area of Devon to be an asylum seekers free zone. This is what the propaganda they were putting out on the doorsteps. Asylum. Can anybody translate asylum seeker? In the week of the election, my daughter was in a small playground run by a manager, and my daughter has a two and a half year old child. The father of the child is West Indian, so to use the currently politically correct term, our child is of mixed cultural heritage. This is the what I call light brown. And when people ask my daughter, what did your dad say? What did your mum say about a little baby? And I said to her, well, what did I say when you told me? And I was shown that my daughter said to me, my first words that came out of my mouth was, at long last, we've got a bit of colour in the family. So she's in a park playing. And there's a boy who's a little, you know, I'm a grandfather, but he's a Jew. He's a kind of, to me, he's the Dalai Lama of South Devon. and so these little young ones are playing in there. A woman, a mother, goes up to the manageress And my daughter heard this woman say, stay away from that. My grandson, stay away. And then, a few minutes later, the woman goes up to the manageress and said, that child over there is bullying my 2-year-old daughter.
What?
Bullying. Bullying. Yeah. Bullying my 2-year-old daughter. My grandson. How could the Dalai Lama do that? Wasn't even near this little girl. What was so concerning about it was, as my daughter said, that others, mothers and fathers said nothing. They just watched. They said nothing. They knew that the little boy, the grandson, and the little girl were nowhere near each other. It was a sheer act of racist discrimination. And my daughter said to the manageress, fine, we'll go and I'm going to drive straight to the newspaper office and say that you're running a racist kindergarten. And then one other mother came up and she said to the manager, the little boy was nowhere near the little girl. It just didn't happen. It was a racist act of discrimination. And then there was a lot of apologies, etc., etc. And this is the first time my daughter in Torquay, the town, had experienced this, and it was in the same week as these elections were taking place with the British National Party. And when I listened and when I talked to her, what, not only concern for this woman who was made the racist remark, but for people not saying anything. They could hear, they could see, they knew what was happening. And that kind of, don't say anything, keep out of it, it's nothing to do with you, mind your own business, etc., etc. What is it that stops people? Is it fear? Is it holding back? Is it not wanting to be involved or whatever? But it's that climate, that social climate, which allows organisations like the British National Party to grow. Because people don't say anything, people don't protest. So in Totnes we were sending of the peace activists to the nearby town of Torquay, doing the door knocking, putting out leaflets of concern, of protest about it. And we went to the very streets where the British National Party candidates were living. And remember, one of them came out, he was sick, and did a Heil Hitler salute. Sick. So sometimes you have to look in our life and to see how we are inwardly. What is to be concerned about? What is to be reflected on? What really matters? And that's where we need to be wisely informed. We need to be able to use our mind well. We need skillful and helpful information. We need to discuss, need to explore, need to question not only our inner life and attitudes, but also and equally how we relate outside. Because if we don't, then these kind of organizations, they grow. They grow on people's passivity. They grow on people's fear. They grow on people's unwillingness to speak up and say something. Just that my daughter, you know, she's got her own strength. She wasn't frightened. She knew what to do. And she would. If she'd gone out of there, I know her. Know her very well. She would have been in that newspaper office like a rocket. Others would have just been frightened and and left. So all this is part of a work, of a challenge, of finding fresh ways to look. And as I say, our relationship thought to thought is an important feature in all of this. Sometimes in the looking in ourselves and the exploration and the going deeper into ourselves, and certainly reflected in some of the listening and the one-to-ones and the small groups, the inquiries as well over the days here together. Sometimes in touching deeper places and responses inside of ourselves, certain experiences can take place. And the Buddha has used two terms. I'll try to explain. One is panya vimuti and the other is cheto vimuti. Panya means wisdom. Vimuti is liberation. Liberation through wisdom. Cheto vimuti is liberation through the mind. I'll touch upon that in a moment or two. In the experiences that we teachers here have listened to over the days here and aspects of teaching, sometimes the world of the known and the familiar, a small number of you have referred to this, suddenly the world of the known and the familiar, I can drop away, sometimes in one of two ways. One way that it can drop away is through the loss of ego about it all. So instead of this is happening to me, I am going through this, I am having to deal with my mind, my heart, my feelings, my thought, my body, my life, etc. Sometimes the I and the me and the my has dropped away. So instead of it seeming so personal, the relationship to it undergoes some change. It might be temporary. And there's more a sense of a kind of process which is unfolding. So it doesn't seem that like this is happening to me and I am undergoing this and I am having to endure or live through this. There's just a process which is going on, an unfoldment which is going on called heart, mind, body, life. There. And that means that one's I and my temporarily has dropped away. Just things are unfolding. And sometimes with the thoughts, I'm sometimes reminded of the old time of the Russian Politburo, where on the 1st of May, all these soldiers would come out, do this big parade, and all the tanks and the bazookas and the cruise missiles or whatever they've got. And then you've got these strange old men standing on a platform with their trilby grey hat on, and for an hour or two they're standing like this, you know, bored out of their minds, it went by in May Day parade in Moscow, the big Russian parade. And I think sometimes we as bringing awareness and witnessing and mindfulness to things, sometimes we need that attitude as well. Here come the thought. Right, pass by it. Here comes another wave of emotion. Comes by. Here comes more reactivity. And here's the judgmental mind coming by. Etc. Or here's the desires. Now it's the fears. Bye-bye, fears. Just stand there and watch it all go by, witnessing the whole flow, etc. So even those funny old men in the Politburo can be inspirational. So sometimes the witnessing power just allows things to fly pass by there. Much in that time, in much to be discovered. What an extraordinary thing that sometimes it feels like strong, this is happening to me. I'm really affected by this. This is really having an impact on me. And sometimes the me just loses its substance. It becomes, as the Buddhists would say, rather not me. It's more just like an unfolding process. Just things are just happening. And it seems much less personal, and it's just, this is the way the life is revealing itself. This is the way life is unfolding itself. And all of that can be expressed seeing some intimation, some whisper, some affirmation of cheto vimuti, freedom through the mind. Mind is still going on. But it hasn't got that stickiness of the I, me and my about it. Even if the issue is still unfolding. It's just unfolding, just passing by through life. And there's cheto vimuti. Some indication, some sense of freedom through the mind. Sometimes, as some of you have reported as well, that the whole of one's life for some moments or longer sometimes can, as it were, drop completely out of consciousness. And what I mean by that, sometimes we feel a strong sense, especially in the practices of being here and now, strong sense of one's presence, real sense of presence, present to the moment, present to the experience, present to the breathing, real strong sense of presence. Yet that whole kind of packet of subject-object, present to what is present, that whole packet sometimes, as has been reported here, sometimes can completely drop away so significantly in those moments that there is only a sense of nothingness. There's only a sense, if that's the right word, only a sense of complete absence of anything. And that can happen with all the body sensitivities, all the body consciousness dropping out, all the content running in and out of the mind dropping out, the consciousness which is so dependent on all of that for its existence, that drops out as well. And then the kind of life kind of comes back in, and one finds that one's made a shift from complete absence into complete presence. And I think, what happened? How did that happen? Well, what was that sense of emptiness and nothingness and just space, or no substance, no me, no mind, no body, no consciousness? What was all that about? And those kind of experiences, which can happen, of course, in meditation, they can happen spontaneously, can happen through a whole variety of reasons which we find hard to explain, can have, in the reflection on them, immense value in terms of being able to accommodate this world of presence and absence, of which the biggest one for us would be called life and death. And the sense of presence and absence is the one that can bring from us the most drama to our life, the most perceptions about, most feelings about. And especially when the death is sometimes running very, very close, and the feeling that the line between life and death is not very far away, it's very, very close. And so sometimes, as I say, these experiences of complete absence of that arise may be a little confusing or a little difficult there, but they're helping us to embrace and accommodate the movement of life from arising to ceasing, from beginning to ending, from presence to absence, from something to nothing. And each time you and I lose something, or we lose someone, or we're aware of the absence of, that, as the Buddha pointed out regularly enough, that awareness of the absence of, without any resistance, is an incredibly important awareness. Because if we're really aware of the absence of, we're really clear about it, it's going to take the sting out of worry about death. It will take the anxiety out of about death, because we've looked at absence, we know what absence is, we know what presence and absence and their interrelatedness is all about, and then we can embrace life and death, beginnings and endings, start and finish, comings and goings, because we've lived and we've been true to life, and in being true to life we said, okay, I'm going to learn to live, to be with all those absences that keep arising in our day-to-day life. I'm going to express as much appreciation for absence as I am for presence. I'm going to take as much interest in absence as I am in what is immediate. And when that gets very, very clear, and the lines, the difference between the two get dissolved, life and death will hold no fear, won't hold worry for us, etc. Because we can abide with both. We can live with both. We can live with life and death in the same embrace. So, just in conclusion here with our meditations and with our awarenesses. Sometimes, as I mentioned, just at the beginning, it's looking and giving attention in life to things that matter and putting our attention to that. And sometimes it's important to find a conviction in ourselves. So even if we're misunderstood, like I mentioned with the parliament situation, even if ideas seem silly, but if one feels there's something valuable, to carry it through, to bring it through. You and I may not see the result, we may not see any benefit in our lifetime, but hopefully others will take it up. We need the Ministry for Peace. Just one small example. We need society and governments to look at this whole issue of violence from the home to war, and to really start attending to this as a civilized way of living in this world. And similarly with the second area part of the talk, with our thoughts, working with our thoughts, the different ways that we can work with it, so that intuitive thought, that instinctive thought which has value to it, can pass through. We can hear it, we can feel it, we can sense it, and that can give us the strength to move with it, rather than not knowing what's a wise and healthy thought and a valid thought, because we're drowning in too many other thoughts, or we're drowning in too much knowledge. And then finally, this looking which keeps our voice alive in this world. And all that's part of the interactive process with life. Follow all of this through, we begin to sense and taste of Cheto Vimuti, liberation, freedom, through the mind, both through the mind. And Panya Vimuti, which is looking at life, and it's a wisdom with existence, and finding freedom and a wisdom which communicates itself. And so, as the Buddha pointed out, there are some people in the world who have genuinely have great inner freedom of mind. He or she may not be able to express it, may not be able to articulate it, or whatever, may not even understand this sense of freedom through the mind, but it's there, and it shows in their happiness, and their contentment, and their clarity, in their depth of being, etc. And then there are some, Panya Vimuti, where the wisdom finds its expressions in different ways, where it gets expressed, where it gets articulated, where it gets explored in various ways, as all of us have been doing here over the days together. And then we can know what genuine freedom is, and not these superficial ideas that get passed on to us by our politicians or our religious leaders or by our economists and financiers, etc. Find out what real deep human freedom is all about and its expression. So let's have a couple of quiet minutes, shall we?